I realized in preparing for this morning that I could almost have started this morning's message with the same opening lines with which I started the message that I brought when I was here in October last year. It was something along the lines of, not everybody welcomed Jesus with open arms. You can go back and dig up the archives, the audio archives, and you can find out what followed after that. But when I was here in October, it was quite early on in the series in Mark's Gospel, and the section that was given to me was from around chapter 2, chapter 3 of Mark, and it had to do with the conflicts of Jesus. And mixed in with the theme of the conflicts of Jesus in the early chapters of Mark is also the theme of the authority of Jesus. That's why there was conflict, because people resented the implied claims of authority. Now, from fairly early on in those opening chapters of Mark, Mark talks, for example, about the way Jesus taught in the synagogue. And he says that the people noticed there was something different about his teaching, something that wasn't true of the people that they normally listened to teaching in the synagogue. They noticed that Jesus taught them as someone who had authority. In other words, as someone has put it, Jesus didn't just clarify something that they already knew, or simply interpret the scriptures in the way the teachers of the law did. He taught them with authority. And Mark goes on, again in Mark chapter 1, to explain how the authority of Jesus was demonstrated in his power to drive out unclean spirits. So not only did the people witness and experience and listen to the teaching of Jesus and notice the authority that he had when he taught, but they also saw when a demon-possessed man, a man under the control of an unclean spirit came in, they saw the power that Jesus had to banish the unclean spirit and set the man free. And that same power, supernatural power, was demonstrated then over disease, and even over the physical elements when Jesus calmed a storm. And Jesus also, Mark says, had authority to forgive sins. Mark chapter 2, the story of the paralyzed man, whose friends very kindly and very inventively, if I could put it like that, managed to get their friend right down in front of Jesus when Jesus was teaching in the house. They got onto the roof. They presumably brought some tools, some equipment with them, managed to clear a hole in the roof, and they lowered their friend down right to where Jesus was. They expected that Jesus would heal him. No doubt the man was hoping that Jesus would heal him. The people who were watching probably thought that that's what was going to happen. And instead of that, at least at the beginning, instead of that, Jesus said to the man, "Your sins are forgiven you." Wasn't what he was expecting to hear. Interesting that, by the way. You know, we've all come here with different reasons and various motivations this morning. Some of us have come because it's the thing that we do. Some of us have come because maybe there's someone that we want to see. Some of us have come because we're facing maybe a choice at a crossroads in life. And we're wondering what God is going to say to us. Wouldn't it be a surprise if the thing that we most needed to hear this morning is, "Your sins are forgiven"? Now, it wouldn't really be a surprise. I know it wouldn't be a surprise for me, because I know that I need to hear that. We need to hear that voice of the grace of God. That's what that man heard. And then Jesus went on to heal the man and thereby demonstrated that he had authority on earth to forgive sins. Now, that started to get him into trouble with the religious leaders, the scribes. They didn't like this, because only God had the authority to forgive sins, they said. And the irritation that the religious leaders felt towards Jesus also began to be extended when they watched the very liberal way that he observed the Sabbath, the things that he felt free to do on the Sabbath day. That offended the Pharisees. And to bring us right up to our passage from this morning, his activities in the temple then went on to offend and upset the Jewish ruling classes. And that's what's happened at the end of Mark chapter 11. Immediately before that, he has gone into the temple. He has cleared out the court of the Gentiles, which had been taken over by the merchants, people selling animals, people exchanging money. It was a legitimate business in a sense. Somebody had to buy animals. If you were traveling from a distant part and had come to Jerusalem for a religious festival, you weren't expected to bring the animals with you. You may have come from somewhere else where the currency was different. There needed to be money changers. But these people had set up such an enterprise and such a business that they'd taken up the court of the Gentiles. The Gentiles were meant to be able not to get right into the center of the temple, but they were at least to be able to get close to a certain extent. And the court of the Gentiles was filled with traders. And Jesus cleared them out and he said, "Don't you know that my house is meant to be a house of prayer for the nations?" And these merchants and exploiters had taken what was meant to be a place of prayer for the nations and they'd turned it into a way of getting themselves rich. He cleared out the temple. And as he had done that, and as he went about teaching in the temple, that's what he's doing. Other Gospels tell us that at the end, in this incident at the end of Mark chapter 11. The other Gospels tell us that he's been teaching. But as he's there, members of the Jewish ruling classes come in and they say to him, "Where do you get the authority to lay claim to the temple in the way that you have? Who do you think you are? What kind of authority have you got to do what you've just done? Who gave you this authority?" And as you noticed in the story, Jesus doesn't answer their question. Not directly, at least. He answers it with another question. They won't answer the question, so he won't answer them. But he goes on then to tell the parable of the vineyard. And I want to suggest to you this morning that when we properly understand the parable of the vineyard and the tenants, we discover quite a bit about the authority of Jesus. I want to give you three observations about the authority of Jesus that we see from all of this. I'll give them to you in summary form, and then we'll dig in a little bit in more detail. First of all, we're going to see that the authority of Jesus was divinely sanctioned. In other words, God sent him. That's the answer to their question. Secondly, we'll see that the authority of Jesus was surprisingly vulnerable. The authorities killed him. And then thirdly, we'll see that the authority of Jesus was ultimately vindicated. God would honor him. His authority was divinely sanctioned. God had sent him. Now this, of course, takes us to the question that they asked of him. What authority did Jesus claim for his actions and who had given him this authority? Now you notice that there are three groups of people who are represented in this delegation that approached Jesus. There are chief priests, there are scribes, and elders. Now, it was representatives of these three groups of people, the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders, who made up what was known as the Sanhedrin. It was the Jewish court, the supreme court of Jewish law. The priests were the priests. They worked in the temple. The chief priests consisted of people who had served as high priests, as Caiaphas did, and you read about him in the Gospels. The elders were not particularly religious people. They weren't religious professionals at any rate, but they were the influential lay leaders in the city and the community of Jerusalem. Many of the elders, many of the lay families, the influential families in Jerusalem, were actually wealthy landowners. And I think that becomes quite significant when you begin to think about the details of the parable. And then the scribes were lawyers, experts in the law. Very often, frequently, associated in the New Testament and the Gospels with the Pharisees and that very strict sect of Judaism. Now, when you realize that these people who are questioning Jesus are all members of the Supreme Court, you realize that although the setting is not a court setting, it's not a formal court setting, it's not a formal charge and a formal hearing, at the same time, this is very serious. These people want to know what's going on in the temple. And to some degree, you have to sympathize with them, don't you? I mean, if they're the rulers of Jerusalem, and if part of their responsibility is to see that the temple is properly taken care of and only authorized individuals are at work in the temple area, well, surely they've the right, at least to some extent, to come in and say to Jesus, well, tell us what's going on here. Who has given you the authority to do this, to do these things? Because what Jesus has done is quite extraordinary. He has basically laid claim to the temple. And so they ask him the question about his authority. But you have to wonder if they really wanted to know the truth. Did they really want Jesus to give them an honest answer? Now you'll notice in the Gospels, and you'll see it maybe particularly, presumably in next week's section in the later part of Mark chapter 12, that from time to time people asked questions of Jesus, not because they really wanted the answer, but because they wanted to try to trap him. They'd ask him a trick question. And they'd hope that somehow he would stumble in his answer. He would say something that he shouldn't really have said, and it would get him into trouble either with religious leaders because he'd said something that was theologically unsound, or maybe they could even get him into trouble with the Roman authorities and get him put to death by the Romans. Hence the question that will come in verse 13 about paying taxes to the Romans. And they often asked him these questions to try to trick him. They weren't necessarily looking for the right answer. And so you wonder, and all the evidence suggests, that when these leaders, these elite leaders of the Jerusalem community, question Jesus about his authority, it's not so much in the sense of, well, we'd really like to know, I just want to make sure that you are who you say you are, that you're entitled to do what you've just been doing in the temple. We just want to make sure everything's in order. Can we see your authorization, please? It's not really like that. What becomes clear is that these people are challenging Jesus. Who do you think you are, more or less, is what they're saying. Who gave you the authority to lay claim to the temple? And instead of answering them, Jesus asks them a question. Look at verse 30. He says, let me ask you a question. Tell me something. The baptism of John, kind of escaped your attention, that John the Baptist was ministering in the area, that he was baptizing people, that he was preaching. Tell me what you think about the ministry of John the Baptist. Was the ministry of John the Baptist from heaven? In other words, did God give him the authority to do what he was doing? Or was his ministry from man, that John just invented himself and decided all by himself this is what he was going to do? And the leaders were trapped. Because if they were to say, well, we think it probably was God who sent him, they knew that the next question would be, well, if you thought that God had sent John the Baptist, why did you not do what John the Baptist told you to do? Why did you not believe him? So they weren't going to go there. But they thought, if we say, well, God didn't send him, his baptism was just a human baptism, it was just something that John thought up off his own bat, well, we're going to be in big trouble with the crowds. Because the crowds revered John the Baptist. They regarded John the Baptist as a prophet. And they thought, well, if we say that John's baptism was not from God, the crowds will be against us. And we'll be in trouble with them. So they were trapped. They couldn't admit that God had sent him because they hadn't listened to him. And they dare not try to say that they would dismiss him as just doing things on his own because they didn't want to risk the anger of the crowd. Now you see the implication. You see what's going on here. If these men were not prepared to acknowledge that God had sent John, well, what use was it in Jesus telling them that God had sent him? They wouldn't want to acknowledge the fact that God had sent Jesus. And as the parable that Jesus tells at the beginning of chapter 12 goes on to show, in actual fact, these leaders were simply the latest in a long line of unfaithful leaders all the way down through the history of the people of Israel who did not want to listen to God. Now we read the passage from Isaiah chapter 5, which, as I said, was clearly in the background, in the mind of Jesus when he told this. This was an image that people would have been familiar with. The Lord and his people, the relationship is like the relationship between a man, a vine grower, and his vineyard. Now, the vine grower is entitled to come to his vineyard, and he's entitled to look for grapes in his vineyard. And the Lord says, I've come to my vineyard, and instead of finding good grapes here, I'm finding wild grapes. And what he meant by that was, as I come to my people to see the fruit of their lives, fruit of righteousness, fruit of justice, fruit of holiness, instead of that, what I'm seeing is violence. And what I'm seeing is bloodshed. And what I'm seeing is injustice. The whole society is full of violence and bloodshed. This is God's vineyard. These are God's people. And down through the years, as the parable says, down through the years, God sent messengers. And when you read back into the prophets in the Old Testament, you see this kind of thing happening over and over again. This is what Isaiah was doing. He was coming and saying, the Lord wants to know what's going on in his vineyard. You've got Jeremiah who addresses the leaders and he says, my shepherds have destroyed my vineyard. Woe to the shepherds. You've got Ezekiel who brings the message that God was against the shepherds. You've got Isaiah in Isaiah chapter 3, again Isaiah, warning that the Lord would enter into judgment with the elders and the judges of his people. He said, they have devoured my vineyard. And so eventually when John the Baptist came, he had come as another one of the servants, and the current crop of leaders in Jerusalem had not believed him. And now Jesus was here. The Son had come. Jesus was here, challenging their authority in Jerusalem. And they were not going to accept it. Not only were the Jewish leaders unwilling to accept the authority of Jesus as someone who'd been sent by the owner of the vineyard, but at the end of the day, they were unwilling to acknowledge God's place among his people. And so Jesus shows them, if only they could see it, where did this authority come from? His authority was divinely sanctioned because God had sent him. One of the interesting differences between Isaiah 5 and this parable is that in Isaiah 5, it's the whole nation that's held responsible. In Mark chapter 12, it's the leaders who are held responsible. Jesus is not particularly getting at the people at this point. In fact, the people are very much on Jesus' side. That's what it says in the context. But it's the leaders who are responsible because they've abused their position. Spiritual leadership is a great privilege, and it's also a great responsibility. The New Testament says that spiritual leadership is a good thing to set your heart on. It's what Paul said to Timothy, talking about elders in 1 Timothy chapter 3. Anyone sets their heart on being an overseer or an elder in the church, they're desiring a good thing. Spiritual leadership is a good thing. It's a good ambition to have to be a spiritual leader. But at the same time, the New Testament warns about going about it in the wrong way and going about it for the wrong reasons. So, for example, Peter talks to elders and he says, elders, as you go about your work of shepherding the flock, do it willingly. Don't do it because someone's twisting your arm up your back. Now, if somebody comes along and says to you, you've got our members meeting, our annual meeting is coming up very soon. I'm sure it's probably too late procedurally and all the rest of it. Someone comes along and says, would you ever think of it standing for a deacon? Or you ever think about allowing your name to go forward for eldership? Peter would say, do it willingly. Don't do it because someone's twisting your arm up your back. He says, elders are to serve eagerly and not out of a desire to make something from it. I think he's probably talking in the context about money. There were people in the early church in the first century who thought that spiritual leadership was actually a way to get rich, believe it or not. Not sure how that would fly in some settings nowadays, but it seemed like maybe an easy way to get rich. What's in it for me? And there may not be very many people who get involved in spiritual leadership in churches nowadays who do it for the money. Most of them don't get any money out of it. But it's still possible that some of us get involved in spiritual leadership for the wrong reasons. It's the what's in it for me. It's possible that you've got somebody who maybe has never had any success in business and has always had a very mediocre job and has never made much of a success of anything. And suddenly, they get the opportunity to have a bit of a responsibility in church, and all of a sudden, they become like the Adolf Hitler of the church because they've been given a little bit of authority and a little bit of power. What's in it for me? Peter says, don't go about it in that way. Do it eagerly, not out of a desire to make something of it. And he says, they're to go about it serving as examples, not domineering the flock. They don't take a whip and say, right, this is what you're going to do. Spiritual leaders are called to actually be able to say, in the words of Paul, follow me the way I follow Jesus. Spiritual leaders are to care for the flock of God, which he has purchased at the price of the blood of his Son. It is God's flock, and they are to look after it for him. Phew. It's a big responsibility, isn't it? And some of you are saying, well, I'm glad that's got nothing to do with me. Well, it does have something to do with you. Because if you're not a spiritual leader, you've got a responsibility to the way, in terms of the way you respond to those people that God has put in spiritual leadership over you. When you hear the kind of things that they're called to do and the kind of people that they're called to be, don't you think you should pray for them? Don't you think that from time to time you should encourage them? It actually says in Hebrews, obey your leaders. They're watching over you as people are going to give an account. And live in such a way that their task and their responsibility is a joy and not a burden. It's got something to say to all of us. But, since it's God's vineyard, it is primarily the leaders who need to remember that this is God's people, and God has entrusted the responsibility to them. Second thing about the authority of Jesus is that it was surprisingly vulnerable. The story in chapter 12, the story of the vineyard, is quite a dramatic story. Now, some of the details probably wouldn't have been unusual in first century Palestine. Many of the people who owned land around Galilee were absentee landlords. That's the way it was. And so, in common with what many people had done, this landlord has his vineyard. He goes about the work of preparation. Jesus tells us some of the details. He plants the vineyard, puts a fence around it. He digs a pit for the wine press. He builds a tower, a lookout tower, a place of security. And then, when it's all ready, he hands it over to tenant farmers. And he goes off to live in another country. He's an absentee landlord. Now, presumably, the arrangement, in terms of rent, presumably the arrangement would have included that they would have given him some of the produce of the vineyard as their rent. And so at the appropriate season, the absentee landlord says, okay, it must be harvest time. I'm going to send a servant to go and get some of what is mine, some of what these people owe me in terms of their rent. So the first servant comes along in verse 3, and the tenants see him coming, and they decide, well, we're not going to give this man anything. They just beat him up, send him away empty-handed. Verse 4, another servant comes. They beat him on the head, and they treat him shamefully. Verse 5, another servant comes along. They take it a step further, and they kill this one. And again in verse 5, Jesus says, other servants are sent. Some of them are beaten, and some of them are killed. And by the time you come to the end of verse 5, the landlord is almost out of options. There are no more servants to send. What is he going to do? Now, bear in mind what I said earlier on when I was describing the people who Jesus was talking to. The elders, the elite, wealthy families of Jerusalem, many of them were wealthy landowners. Try to listen to the story through their ears. What would they have done? You know, they're listening to this story about this landowner and his tenants not only disregard the servants that he sends to get his rent, but they actually beat them up and they kill them. I mean, what landowner is going to tolerate that kind of thing? How many more times is this man going to allow these people to treat him with such disregard? Have these tenants forgotten who the vineyard actually belongs to? What would the people in Jesus' audience have done? What would you have done if you were a landlord in this situation? Maybe some of you are landlords. Maybe some of you have got a second home and you rent it out. What would you do if the time of the month comes along and you're going to receive your rent and the person doesn't pay, it doesn't come through the bank, and you say to the estate agent, would you mind popping in there and just checking what's going on? And the estate agent who's handling your business goes there and the tenant beats him up and throws him back out again and doesn't give it. How long would you tolerate that kind of thing? The owner here sends more servants, and eventually, well, he's down to his last option. And he decides that he will send his son, his only son. And he thinks to himself, in terms of the story, he thinks to himself, surely when they see my son coming, they'll feel some sense of shame about the way they've been behaving up to this point. There'll be something, some sense of honor that will stir in them. And when they see him coming, they'll respect him, even if they haven't respected all of the other people that I've sent. But actually, that's not what happens. Maybe they think when the son comes along, maybe they think, oh, the master's dead. They've been waiting for the master to come and sort this thing out. He's not appeared, the son has come, and they assume the master's gone, and they think to themselves, well, you know what? We get rid of the son, it's ours. Possession is 9/10 of the law. If we get rid of the son, there's no heir. Who's going to claim it? Nobody's going to claim it. We're already here, we get to keep it. And something like that went through their minds. And so they kill the owner's son and they throw him out of the property. And the master's plan has backfired. What if, instead of sending his son, he had actually turned up personally? Maybe turned up with a private army and had dealt with the tenants the way he eventually was going to deal with them by the time the end of the story comes about. What if he had done that? Well, he didn't. He sent his son and the tenants have put his son to death. Now, we need to be a little bit careful the way we understand all of the details of this parable, and any parable, in fact, because we're not meant to take away from the story the idea that somehow when God sent Jesus, it was a great shock and a great surprise to God that Jesus was crucified. God sent him knowing what was going to happen. In fact, just a few chapters before, if you're back in Mark chapter 8, verse 31, Jesus began to teach that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by, here they are, the elders and the chief priests and the scribes, and be killed. Now, Jesus knew what was going to happen. But don't miss what's going on here. The vulnerability of the authority of Jesus. Here is the man who had the authority to forgive sins. Here is the man who had the authority to drive out demons, who had the power to cast out disease, who had the power to calm storms, who had the authority to stand in the temple and clear it out of its traitors so that it would be a house of prayer for all of the nations. Here is the man who had the confidence and the authority to stand and face the so-called rulers of Jerusalem. And yet, he allowed those same people to stage a trial and have him put to death at the hands of the Romans. The vulnerability of Jesus. I read a story, it's told by Kenneth Bailey. Kenneth Bailey has written a number of books on the Middle Eastern culture behind the Gospels, and much of his work is very, very helpful. And he tells a story about King Hussein of Jordan. Some of you are old enough to remember King Hussein of Jordan, 30 or so years ago, one of the figures in the Middle East. Now, this is a true story. Bailey has been very careful to verify it. It's a true story, quite a remarkable story. I'll read it the way he tells it. One night, in the early 1980s, King Hussein of Jordan was informed by his security police that a group of about 75 Jordanian army officers were at that very moment meeting in a nearby barracks plotting a military overthrow of the kingdom. The security officers requested permission
to surround the barracks and arrest the plotters. After a somber pause, the king refused and said, "Bring me a small helicopter." The helicopter was brought. The king climbed in with the pilot and himself and flew to the barracks and landed on its flat roof. The king told the pilot, "If you hear gunshots, fly away at once without me." Unarmed, the king then walked down two flights of stairs and suddenly appeared in the room where the plotters were meeting and quietly said to them, "Gentlemen, it has come to my attention that you are meeting here tonight to finalize your plans to overthrow the government, take over the country, and install a military dictator. If you do this, the army will break apart and the country will be plunged into civil war. Tens of thousands of innocent people will die." "Excuse me. There is no need for this. Here I am. Kill me and proceed. That way, only one man will die." After a moment of stunned silence, the rebels as one rushed forward to kiss the king's hand and feet and pledge loyalty to him for life. What a powerful way, and yet what a humble, vulnerable way to transform his enemies. And what a picture of the gospel. God, who has every right to claim our allegiance, who has every right to inspect our individual lives for the fruit of righteousness, God who has had to absorb our rejection, our defiance, our indifference to Him, instead of wiping us out as rebels, sends His Son to face death at our own hands. You and I might say, "Well, just a minute, I wasn't there. Death at our hands. I wasn't there." Well, you weren't. But you know, when you start to talk like that, believe it or not, you're actually behaving the way some of these leaders behaved. In another part, it's in Matthew's Gospel, Jesus talks about the religious leaders and he says, "You know, you people, you decorate the tombs of the prophets. You put up monuments for the prophets. These prophets that your fathers killed. And you're trying to say that you would never, if you'd been alive in the days of your fathers and your ancestors, you would never have killed the prophets the way they did." Jesus said, "You know, you're just chips off the old block." And the fact that they did to Jesus what they did to Jesus just a short time afterwards showed that it was like father, like son. And so for any of us who would say, "Well, if I had been there, I wouldn't have done, I wouldn't have been in the crowd baying for blood. I wouldn't have been like the disciples and running away." Of course you would. In fact, it was your sin and my sin that put him there. Think of the way Stuart Townend put it, "Behold the man upon the cross, my sin upon his shoulders. Ashamed, I hear my mocking voice call out among the scoffers. My voice call out among the scoffers." It was my sin that held him there until it was accomplished. His dying breath has brought me life. I know that it is finished. The surprising vulnerability of the authority of Jesus. But notice finally that Jesus' authority will be ultimately vindicated. God will honor him. The owner's patience eventually runs out. And in verse 9, Jesus said, "What will the owner of the vineyard do? He will come and destroy the tenants and give the vineyard to others." Now, it would be difficult to argue with that. There were, according to Luke, there were some people who thought this was a little harsh. But just listening to the parable, it would be very hard to argue with what this man was going to do. The tenants deserve it. Now, again, remember, many of the people who are listening, many of the people that Jesus is targeting with this story are wealthy landowners. And they have a dilemma. There's something very ironic about this. Because as wealthy landowners, their sympathy is with the landowner. And they would be saying, "Well, of course he's got every right to go and destroy those tenants after the way that they have behaved. We would do exactly the same." But they were caught again. because they realized that in this story, they were not the wealthy landowner. The wealthy landowner was God, and they were actually the tenants who had refused to listen to God and had refused to give God what God was entitled to. And so, the vineyard would be taken away, the leadership would be taken away and given to someone else. And that's exactly what was going to happen. Now, at this point, it's the leaders, it's not the whole people who are in the spotlight. But eventually, Jerusalem is going to miss its great opportunity. Jesus will be vindicated. He will be crucified. He will be thrown outside the city. But he will be vindicated. And an awful lot of people in Jerusalem are going to find themselves on the wrong side. Now you notice the quotation that Jesus puts in verse 10 and 11. It's from Psalm 118. Now it's interesting that he quotes from Psalm 118. It's not very long, just a couple of days since he's triumphantly entered the city of Jerusalem and people are saying, "Blessed is the one who comes in the name of the Lord." That's from Psalm 118. And so is this. This stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. This was the Lord's doing and it is marvelous in our eyes. You can picture the builders at work. Say they're building the Temple of Solomon. And here's a stone, and they think, "Oh, I don't think we've really got much use for this," and they discard it. But eventually that stone takes a key place. Maybe the top stone on the parapet, on the roof of the temple. It takes a key place. And in the psalm, as the psalmist wrote that, he's probably thinking of a sense of the reversal of fortunes of the nation that's discarded, and yet God exalts it. And Jesus uses the psalm as a reference to himself. The builders are the leaders of the nation. He is the stone that the builders reject. But he says, that stone that's rejected, that stone is going to be the cornerstone. The builders will reject him, but the situation will be reversed. Now, it wasn't very long after this. After the events of his death, and his resurrection, and his ascension to heaven, it wasn't long after it that Peter was preaching at the temple. Peter and Mark were very closely associated, so Peter probably was very well aware of what was going on, of what had gone on in Mark chapter 12. Peter's preaching in the temple. He just met a beggar lying there at the gate of the temple. This man had never walked in his entire life, never been able to walk, always been lame. And every day, people would bring him, well, what better place to go than the temple? Bring him and we'll put him at the gate of the temple. Because those religious people, as they go to worship God, part of their worship is giving alms, giving charity to the poor. And, well, they'll give him a little bit that he needs just to keep him going because he can't work, he can't even walk. And as Peter and John are going to the temple, he sees them coming and he starts to look at them. And he's gazing at them because he thinks, well, these men are going to give me something. And they stop and they say, "You know, don't be looking at us for money. We don't have any money. We've nothing to give you. We don't have silver. We don't have gold. But tell you what, we'll give you what we have. In the name of Jesus of Nazareth, rise up and walk." And the man stood up and he started to walk. And Peter started to preach. And Peter started to tell the people that it was Jesus who had done this. He says, "You remember Jesus? Not so long ago, he was crucified here in this city. Not so long ago, the rulers of this place threw him out. You people rejected him. You killed the author of life. But God raised him from the dead." And he's preaching. And the temple police arrive and they say, "Hey, just let's calm this thing down a bit." They were sent by the Sadducees. The Sadducees didn't believe in the supernatural. There was no such thing as the resurrection from the dead. So they couldn't have Peter preaching this, especially preaching it about Jesus. And they say, "You're not going to talk like this." And they're dragged in front of the priests and the elders and the scribes. There they are again. To give account of what's happening. And you know what Peter said to them? He said, "This Jesus is the stone that was rejected by you, the builders, which has become the cornerstone." God has vindicated him. And God has made him the Savior. And that means
that as we finish this reflection this morning, the point of it all is how we respond to Jesus Christ. His authority is divinely sanctioned. God has sent him. His authority is surprisingly vulnerable because the people to whom he came were able to reject him and put him to death. But through his resurrection and his ascension, his authority was ultimately vindicated, and it will be vindicated. Because there will be a day when every knee will bow and every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. And that includes all of us. Some of us have already done it. Some of us are glad that we've done it. We're happy that we've done it. We say Jesus is Lord and we're glad to sing it. And we're glad to say it and we're glad to live it. And I wonder if there's somebody here this morning and you haven't done it yet. That, in the end of the day, is the point of this. The authority of Jesus, ultimately vindicated. So that the only really significant decision that you have to make is whether you will acknowledge his authority or not.